Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sarigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
God is the object of positive inquiry, page 47, is defined in the second code of Vedanta Sutra, Janmadyasya Yataha, he from whom proceeds the creation, maintenance, and dissolution of this universe is Brahman. All right, so we're supposed to inquire about Brahman, so from whom this creation, maintenance, and destruction comes, that's Brahman. Right, so that's the Brahman we're supposed to ask about. Right, not the one that just sits there and does nothing. Right, the one who's something's happening. Right, because if you understand these higher, then automatically the lower ones are coming. Mm. Right. The universe is full of qualities that emanate from God. Hence, God Himself must be full of qualities. By what authority can we be sure that the universe is real and that God is the source of it? The third code of Vedanta Sutra answers: Shastriyonitvat. It is revealed in the Vedic scriptures. Right, so that was the point, is that since actually, well, I mean, from two things, is that you're dealing with the mundane, which can't conceive of transcendental. Right, so it's only by being empowered by the chit potency that that is actually, one can get some benefit like that. So then, that needs to be that we are viewing things through Shastra. Otherwise, we tend to just view things as we please, right? Because the reason we do anything is because it pleases us. So then our view of things, what facts we notice are still what pleases us. I remember once seeing in a radio station, I'm not sure if it still works like that, but whatever it is, the example works, is that they had this thing, this big machine, they call it a ticker tape machine. So all it does, it has a piece of paper that's this wide, you know, so that's ticker tape. And it's connected to all the, news agencies of the world. You know, UTI, Reuters, all these things. Whoever is giving news is connected to that. All it does all day is print out news, just in one big long, you know, we know, just in sentences one after another. Like that. So all day that's going on. Now the DJ goes and, you know, in between breaks, you know, then he goes and looks at this. But there's unlimited news, but they pull something that they feel is going to be relevant for the time. You know, whatever's in the news now. There's an earthquake somewhere. So any earthquake anywhere on the planet, they'll pull that. Or, you know, there's a music festival here. So any music, it's like that. They do like this. But there's unlimited news. You know, they're talking about some old lady getting run over, you know, walking across the street. You know, it's all that's there, but it's not mentioned, you know, unless something, you know, how you say, the president's grandmother gets run over. Then all old ladies all over, you know, there's a proliferation of old ladies being run over, like this. But it's going on every day. Does this make sense? So what's happening here, according to the philosophy, is according to their samskars, they're going to pull that information they think is important. Does that make sense? So much information is there, but we only take that one. Why? Yes, because we're attached. So that's the problem. That's why Shastra Yonitvat. It is revealed in the Vedic scriptures, right? So how do we know what's going on? How do we know the authority? How do we even know who God is? It's through the scriptures. Right? God reveals himself through the scriptures because that's something that we can approach. Right? So Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, that we can approach. So that's why it's important. Otherwise, our own limitations are there, plus the senses themselves are imperfect, plus we're attached, plus we're crazy, right? You know, plus we make mistakes. So all this put together, it means that actually what actually we're perceiving saying is real may not be. So those people that when we look at something and go, wow, that looks nice, they also go, yeah. But if we necessarily go, that looks nice, no, that's pretty stupid. That's lame. You know, that we don't stand next to them anymore. You understand? So the whole point is in their mind, in reality, it's not nice. And in the other person's mind, it is nice. Right? Because one of them's looking at the aesthetics of it. The other one's looking at how much money that cost, and you could have fed so many poor people. Another one is like, they put it right in the middle of the street like that. You know, you could have put a parking lot there. I mean, there's so many ways that people look at stuff. You know, and then the last guy, you call that art? You know, like that. So, you know, like that. So it's...
Sometimes we listen to different preachers.
Right.
And then what happens is a big confusion. Because you go and then one preacher, it's not according to the Shastra, but he puts it through his own mind and senses and perspective and frame of reference. And then the next one comes, and then it's like two opposite worlds. And then devotees get confused because they don't understand. You know, why is some emphasis on this and why is on that? And they get even more bewildered than they were before the class. So then, how can we figure this out?
Means you have the high side. See, Krishna is unlimited, so there's unlimited ways you could approach. So there are traditional aspects that are prominent, right? There's traditional approaches. But, you know, main thing is that it should be relevant to whoever you are dealing with, right? What is your audience? Is to speak according to that. So ideally, a preacher, though, he can speak on many things. So he would be careful that it doesn't bewilder his audience. But sometimes you can't always tell just by looking what's going to be the reaction. You know, I remember once speaking a bunch of brahmacharis, you know, really fired up, hardcore brahmacharis, like that. And I was saying something and talking this and that. And then suddenly their reaction is all this kind of new agey, you know, oh, you can't say like that. And it's kind of, huh? You know, it's kind of like those big monster guys, you know, like that. And the crusaders are coming along and they're like this and that. And, you know, what can we do? You know, how can we get by? Oh, bring us some shrubbery. You know, it's kind of, what does this got to do with anything? You know? Right. You know, it's kind of like, you know, where did that come from? You know, so... Sometimes you do get that, is they look one way, and but they respond another. So you know, you kind of deal according to what it should be, what the response you get. That would be the preacher themselves, because much of the time somebody, you know, another is that there's an aspect that they feel is very important within the society, so they're preaching that. So that's the nice thing about Krishna consciousness: all things are important, but at the same time there is a hierarchy, you know. So sometimes it's taken for granted. Okay, chanting and this and that's important, but this aspect's being neglected. So therefore, they bring that out. But it if it's not given in context, then you might take it that it's more primary. It's primary, you know, than it should be, you know. So then, that aspect comes there. You know, like that. Because the thing is we're engaging our conditioning in the Lord's service, but because it's engaged, therefore it's purified, it's nice. But one has to be very careful is that to know what is primary, what's secondary, or what's more important, what comes to, you know, in other words, what's first and then what's after. So the acharyas give that. That's why then living the path given by the acharyas becomes very essential. Because otherwise, Shastras talks on all that. That's the business of Shastras. Anything that a human being would think or talk about or do, the Shastra deals with it. So that way the human can engage everything, you know, in transcendence, you know, or in pious work, or in devotion. That's the idea. So, but it's ideal that someone, you know, has a topic or something that works. Does this get anywhere, or?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because it's no use going into their condition, and so they're saying like this and this and that. Then one doubts the whole process. Because the point is even you're taking the conditioning that's connected to Krishna. Like, you know, you have a potato. It's just an ordinary potato, right? In fact, you know, it may have been grown on the other side of the fence, right? But the point is you offer it to Krishna, and it's a good potato, right? It's a spiritual potato. So that's the whole point is whatever it is, if it's connected, then it becomes okay.
Yeah, because previously we discussed in the morning class, then if it's not in accordance with the scriptures, then it's a disturbance.
Yeah, it's a disturbance.
So many people are disturbed because of that. You actually, you know...
That's there. If it's not based on scripture, then it's a problem.
It's just one mind, you know, against another mind, yeah. And then the whole thing is going on and nobody knows what, you know...
Yeah, no, that's it. If it's not backed by scripture, then it's a problem. Like that. But if it is backed by scripture, but it seems to be a different perspective, that's going to come. Because Krishna is unlimited. So you can get that. That's why one keeps association of those who, how they explain things you can relate to. Right? Like that. That's the meaning of swajati. Right? So if you can relate to everybody, then you have a very big group. Like that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's also there. The universe has form. If God is the origin of the universe, then he must himself possess a form. But the Vedic scriptures declare that this form is not limited and imperfect like the forms of the material creation. In other words, the principle of form is there. But the detail of that material, temporary form with flaws, made of material energy, that's different, right? Because the point is the principle always works. Details will change, right? So that's the difficulty. We get caught up in details. Like the Mayavadi is looking at details. He's not looking at that the principle, right?
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
From the Upanishads, we learn that God's qualities are satyam, janam, anantam, sundaram, anandamayam, amalam, eternity, knowledge, endlessness, beauty, bliss, and perfection. This means that God's form is one of infinite and all-pervasive sublime consciousness. A materialistic thinker may object that all-pervasive form is a contradiction of terms. The answer is that it is not. Once the spiritual substance of God's form is accepted, spirit is the most subtle energy. Even in our experience of subtle material energy, we see there's no contradiction between pervasiveness and form. For instance, the pervasiveness of sound is not impeded when sound is given form, is in the form of beautiful music.
Nice example.
Yeah. God's form is one. Okay, let's see. Okay. Yeah, it means there's not a problem with the formless and the form being together. They coexist very well. Like that. God's form is one, but is understood differently from different angles of vision. Just as a mountain is seen differently by a person as he approaches it from a great distance and climbs to the top. From the great distance of theoretical speculation, God is known as Brahman, a vague and impersonal being. A closer look at God is made possible by yoga, by which he is perceived as Paramatma, the Supersoul, who dwells within the heart of every living being, and who inspires the soul with knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. And finally, from the perspective of bhakti, pure devotion, one may know God in his feature of personal perfection called Bhagavan. Vedanta Sutra 1.1.12 states, Anandamaya, Anandamaya Bhyasat. The Parabrahman, highest God, is Anandamaya. Anandamaya means of the nature of pure bliss. This is a clear reference to God's Bhagavan feature, which is all blissful due to its being the reservoir of unlimited positive transcendental attributes, such as beauty, wealth, fame, strength, knowledge, and renunciation. The Mayavadis take Anandamaya to mean merely absence of sorrow. But as, right, so that, you know, that's a lower, just like we see in the Karma monks, the earlier stage, just removal of the pain, and then later it has to be happiness. Because they always talk about this, they never say it's just the absence of sorrow. I mean, it's of course there, if you're going to be happy, there has to be an absence of sorrow. But the point is it's not... But as Baladev Vidyabhushan writes in the Govinda Bhasya, the affix mayat indicates abundance, an abundance of ananda, or bliss. The sun is called Jyotirmaya, of the nature of abundant light, and not merely of the nature of absence of darkness. Right? The sun is the embodiment of the absence of darkness. Right? No one would buy that one. Even though technically, yes, okay.
It's very undark in here.
Yes, it's very undark in here. Today is so undark. Yeah. Be interesting. Similarly, Anandamaya means he whose essential nature is abundant bliss. The Taittiriya Upanishad 271 states, Raso Vaisaha. He is of the nature of sweetness. The soul who realizes him attains to that divine sweetness. Okay, so this is all, it means your Vedanta will be explaining all this nicer, because it gets into this detail. We notice up to now, the other schools, the other five schools, don't really explain God as a person. Even Shankara he'll get only to Brahman. Mm. So all of them deal at best with Brahman, or some aspect. They don't even necessarily get seriously into that. But yoga then will get into Paramatma. Right, so there's some aspect there. But none of them describe Bhagavan, so that's described in Vedanta. The spiritual form of God. Vedanta Sutra 3.2.23 states, Tadavyaktam aha. The form of Brahman is unmanifest, so the scriptures say. Okay, the form of Brahman is unmanifest, so the scriptures say. The next code adds, Api samradhane pratyaksha anu manabhyam. But even the form of Brahman becomes directly visible to one who worships devoutly. So teach the scriptures. Right? So it's saying, the scriptures are saying, he's unmanifest, but the form becomes directly visible to one who worships with devotion. Api, but samradhane, intense worship, pratyaksha, directly visible. Anum amanabhyam, as inferred from scriptures. The Mayavadis hold that the form of God is the material symbol imagined by the devotee as a meditational aid. When the devotee attains liberation, he realizes that God is formless. But this idea is contradicted by Vedanta Sutra 3.2.16. Aha cha tan matram. The scriptures declare that the form of the Supreme consists of the very essence of his self. And furthermore, Vedanta Sutra 3.3.36 asserts that within the realm of Brahman, the devotees see other divine manifestations which appear even as physical objects in a city. Anantara bhuta gramavat swatmana antara, inside, bhuta, physical, gramavat, like a city, swatmana, to his own, i.e. to the devotees. The personalist schools of Vedanta, identify the personal form of God indicated here as the transcendental form of Vishnu or Krishna. The Brahmapura, city within Brahman, is identified as the divine realm of Vishnu, known as Vaikuntha. This conclusion is corroborated by the Srimad Bhagavatam, written by Vyas as his own natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra. The first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam begins with the phrase Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, Janmadyasya Yataha, which means I offer my respectful obeisances to Bhagavan Vasudev, Krishna, the source of everything. Vyasa employs the word Janmadyasya Yataha, which comprised the second sutra of the Vedanta Sutra, in the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, to establish that Krishna is Brahman, the absolute truth. This is clear testimony of the author's own conclusion about the ultimate goal of all Vedic knowledge. That means your Gita is ending with this, you know, give up all other kinds of religion, just surrender to him. Bhagavatam opens with that, right? So then that means it's the next natural stage. But we see is that the Vedanta Sutra opens with Janmadyasya Yataha, and also Bhagavatam opens with that. So then they're naturally running that one is the same subject matter as the other. Does that make sense? Because your opening is how you understand what the Shastra is talking about. Vedanta Sutra 416 states, Adityadi mataya cha ango papatehe. Reason dictates that the sun and other cosmic manifestations be thought of as originating from the limbs of the Lord. The reason referred to here may be termed in Western philosophical language the argument of design, that because the cosmos is arrayed as if according to design, it is logical to seek a designer as its cause. Scripture explains that the design of the universe, the Vishwarup, universal form, is based upon the eternal transcendental form of Krishna. The sun and moon are said to be the eyes of the universal form. They derive their splendor from the spiritual eyes of Krishna. In turn, the eyes of all creatures are derived from the eyes of the Vishwarup. Krishna is the original designer. He draws the design of the material universe from his personal, non-material form, which is the source of everything. The form of the Lord may be meditated upon in this way as long as the soul is embodied in matter. Right? It's useful to see like that, but the point is it's meant for this first stage of God realization of dealing with the Brahman aspect. Right? So that means if we're thinking of things in a material way, by applying the Brahman aspect, then we're seeing the mechanics of something. It means we're attracted by something. So the point is if you look at the mechanics very carefully, you see that what you're attracted to is not the thing, but it's actually the Lord. Does that make sense? Right? Right, so it says, as long as the soul is embodied in matter. In the spiritual world, they don't worry about Brahman or Paramatma because they're dealing with Bhagavan. As mentioned, the Mayavadis believe that meditation upon the form of the Lord is to be given up when the soul is at last freed of matter. But Vedanta Sutra 4.1.12 states, Aprayanat tatrapi hidrishtam. Scripture reveals that worship of the form of the Lord should be done up to liberation. Aprayanat, and even thereafter, tatrapi. Balade Vidyabhushan writes in his commentary, the liberated souls are irresistibly drawn to worship the Lord because he is so beautiful and attractive. The force of his beauty compels adoration. A person suffering from jaundice is cured by eating sugar, but he continues eating sugar even after the cure. Not because he has any disease, but because the sugar is sweet. So also is the case of liberated souls in the worship of the form of the Lord. Right? Does that make sense? So that's also how you get, you know, by chanting Hare Krishna is the process, but chanting Hare Krishna is the goal. Right? Because chanting will free you from material contamination, but chanting's so nice that once you're freed, you still want to chant.
Yeah.
Right? It's just we chant now as sadhana because we don't have that taste. Mm-hmm. But once the taste is there, you're doing because of the taste, not because you're getting purified.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this applies to all the nine processes of bhakti.
Yeah. Because devotional service itself is the process, and the same devotional service is the goal. But Shuddha Bhakti is both. So that's what's so nice about it. So in the conditioned state, then we become purified. You know, but even after liberation, then one finds that it's so nice, one wants to continue. Relation of God to the world. In our study of the other systems of Vedic philosophy, we have seen various explanations of the existence of the world. In Nyaya, God is the operative cause of the world, but atoms are the material cause. Right? So it means he's what's managing it, but the material cause, what's going on, that's the atoms themselves. Right? In Shankya, creation is regarded as the spontaneous result of the contact between Prakriti and Purusha. The Shankya philosophy says there's no need for God in his system, but he fails to explain what governs the coming together of Prakriti and Purusha in the first place, and how, you know, that Purusha is so small, how is he arranging all this, all the detail, how all the leaves on the tree are working, right, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, like that, you know, so that's the problem. Patanjali says God is the Supreme Self, distinguished from other selves. And he is the intelligent governor of Prakriti and Purusha. But Patanjali nonetheless accepts the Shankya view that Prakriti and Purusha have no origin. Right, so God is separate from that. So maybe he's taking care of this and that. But the point is there's no origin. But the point is, we'll also say there's no origin, because they've always existed. But the point is still, it's God who is the source. Does this make sense? Yeah. So this is the difficulty that comes up, is they'll accept the truth up to a point and then stop. Like the Purusha and Prakriti. Okay, is that you have Prakriti there, but when Purusha then is there and identifies itself as Purusha, then Prakriti manifests all the different forms. But that happens after the Lord glances. So the jivas with false ego enter Prakriti. Then Pradhan turns into Mahatattva. Right? So Pradhan is everything's together, it's unmanifest, and then it's manifest in the 24 elements. Right? So make sense? Mm-hmm. So they go up to that point and stop. But the point, they don't know there's before that. Does that make sense? God as creator plays no essential role in the Mimamsaka system, which believes that the world as a whole is eternal, though its gross manifestations may come and go. Right. So, as a creator doesn't. So maybe there's some element of he's there and maintaining, you know, as the operative cause, like in the others. But there's no creation. There's no destruction. Right. Even though all there is creation and destruction going on at every moment. But somehow or another, they kind of finesse that one. Right. Discounting all these theories, Vedanta Sutra defines God as He among all beings, who alone is simultaneously the operative, material, formal, and final cause of the cosmos. So he's all of them. Otherwise, they want to say he's this or that. We'll say he's predominantly this one. You can say he's the final cause, because then the formal cause is taken care of by his internal potency, right? The material, the operative cause is taken care of by the jiva. The material cause is taken care of by the material energy. But the point is all these are his energies, his three energies. So in other words, we can see God is the final cause and his internal, external, and marginal potencies. That's how you get the four kinds of cause. But still, he's the cause of them. And he's the governor of them, so it still works.
Right? So, four causes: formal, material, operative, and
final. Or ultimate, or absolute, or So the final is Krishna, the formal is the internal potency. Then that's reflected into the operative and material. Right? Because in other words, final is the masculine, formal is the feminine.
Okay.
Right? So when you reflect that, then the operative is the masculine and the material is the feminine. So all it is the jiva can either think he's acting on behalf of the Lord with his energy and serving him, or he can think, I am the master of the energy. So either way, you know, it can work. So if he's dealing with I'm servant, then he's actually dealing with internal potency. It's being done through the medium of the external potency, but it's still internal potency. But if he's dealing that I'm the master, then he's dealing with the external potency. Right? That's illusion, that's maya. So it says jiva. Oh, GBS. I said jiva. And I said, oh, okay. Jiva sweater. Okay.
GBS, maybe some Swami, I don't know him yet.
JBS.
Jivas.
Huh? Jivas. Jivas, yeah. It's just, see, it's what you're missing here. And it's just this going back to the ancient system where once you know how to read, you drop all the vowels. You know, like the Torah and stuff like that. So this is Jivas.
Jivas.
Right?
Let's consult the supplier about that.
Yes.
The dots are actually placed under, so it's the vowel version of the...
Oh, okay, yeah, so just to show that it's there, just in case you missed.
Yeah. Great success.
As the intelligence behind creation, he is the operative cause. As the source of Prakriti and Purusha, he is the material cause. As the original transcendental form, of which the world is but a shadow, he is the formal cause. As the purpose behind the world, he is the final cause.
Mm.
Right? So in other words, he is everything. But at the same time, he's separate from all that. That's his uniqueness.
Maharaj, you mentioned the operative cause is the jiva.
Yes.
As the intelligence behind creation, so Krishna comes through that intelligence to the jiva to do something, to operate.
Yeah, I mean, you see, intelligence is still, it's his potency,
uh-huh.
Right? So it's still there because you require intelligence to be the operative cause. Because it's, in others, with knowledge and endeavor, then you're able to do. But still, Krishna is knowledge and Krishna is ability.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still the operative cause. The jiva identifies, mm-hmm. This is me. And the material energy, because why you say there's separate is material cause, because we make that endeavor, but it's material energy itself that transforms. But he's the source of that energy.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So he's the source of that. So therefore, he's the material cause. Right? Like that. And all, So because the jiva's there, then you can say then that material cause is happening. If the jiva wasn't there, it wouldn't necessarily.
There'll be no need.
It would just, however it's needed. But because we could say, the jiva's not there, does that when the tree falls, does it make sound? The point is there are jivas there, so it does make sound. You know, just because you're not there, you're not the supreme jiva, so that's why, therefore. Right?
Okay. That's the trick. They apply that, but they miss.
They miss everybody else there.
Yeah.
What about the tree that the tree fell on? It's there, you know, like that. There's another interesting thing there, because the triangle, the upper triangle, that's the masculine principle. So this gives the idea that, you know, the would this be the conditioned jiva? He's taking the masculine role. You know, I'm the controller and enjoyer, so therefore that, or...
It's from the controllers, right? Yeah, the controllers.
Yeah.
From now on, it's just going to be, no, I'm not going to wear that.
take it off.
This is too many questions.
Or at the same time, it's in the neck, it's in the opposite triangular form. So then that has that combination between the Prakriti and Purusha. So does that mean that this is a Shankya sweater?
No. putting the child on the option.
I see. Okay. Okay.
Calvary Moonism.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Like that. Yeah, okay. So is that covered monism? That means Buddhism, right? So, yeah. So it's actually a Buddhist sweater.
He doesn't exist.
Yeah. If no one notices, does it exist? Okay. As the original transcendental form of which the world is but a shadow, he is the formal cause, right? Because everything is there in its original form, and then this is a reflection of that or a shadow of that. So he's that origin from which it is. So therefore he's the formal cause. And the whole purpose of it is to attain him, so he's the final cause. Mayavad philosophy avoids the issue of causation by claiming that the world, though empirically real, is ultimately a dream. But since even dreams have a cause, the Mayavadi quote-unquote explanation explains nothing, right? So they avoid causation. We don't avoid causation, you know. So then that's the... In the Vishishtadvaita explanation, the material world is the body of God, the Supreme Soul. But the Dvaita school does not agree that matter is connected to God as body as is to soul, because God is transcendental to matter, right? So they're trying to make that point there. Because we're saying is here is that material manifestation here, that being the universal form, it's the form of the Lord, but it's the material form, right? So it's how the Lord is manifested through matter, by his potencies. So it's not him as a person, but it's still his potencies. But then, sorry?
Therefore, Madhva doesn't accept, actually. The only one who doesn't accept
Is Madhva, because he's trying to make very clear that there is nothing mundane at all, because he's just trying to separate it, because otherwise then the Maya bodies will find some little footnote. So anything that they could grab onto, he just, you know, forget it. You know, so. Because the point is as Bhagavan, yes, it's not him. So you could say from that standpoint, it's correct. You know, but if you're going through the mechanics of it, no, this is how it all works. So he has a specific purpose. You know, is that that Shankara has already reestablished the Vedic culture. Ramanuja has already preached. They're still Mayavadis. Mm. Right? So therefore, you have to get out the more serious weaponry. You know? Just like that, you know. You've used all the fine stuff before, right? You know. Now you just bring in a club and just smash it like that. That's the idea. Right? Vayu, yes. Because Madhvacharya is Vayu. He's Hanuman. Mm. Like that. He's Bhima. Right? So you can understand this. There's a common thread here.
Hanuman is soft preaching.
Huh?
Not in line with soft preaching.
Not exactly. He's never been. That's his whole point, is Vishishtadvaita, Vishuddhadvaita are too soft. So he just comes in, you know. Right? Yeah. The world of matter is full of misery, but since Vedanta defines God as Anandamaya, how can non-blissful matter be said to be his body? The truth, according to the Advaita school, is that matter is ever separate from God. But yet is eternally dependent upon God, by God's will, says the Advaita school, matter becomes the material cause of the world. Right. So the point is it's still based on him, but it's him, it's his potencies. How we're saying he's non-different, but the thing is here is they're bringing out the difference, so they can't bring in that aspect of the non-difference. So you don't bring in, because it's this side of it is correct, but then there's the other side that is his potency, is he's non-different from his potency. So in this way, it's him. But because they're not working with the similarity, they're always working with the difference, right? So they won't deal with this. Right? the Shuddha Dvaita school cannot agree with the Dvaita school that matter is the material cause, because matter has no independent origin apart from God. Matter is actually not different from God in the same way as effect is not different from its cause, although there is an appearance of difference. The Dvaita Advaita school agrees that God is both the cause and effect, but is dissatisfied with the Shuddha Dvaita school's proposition that the difference between God and the world is only illusory. The Dvaita Advaita school says that God is neither one with nor different from the world. He is both. A snake, the Dvaita Advaita school argues, can neither be said to have a coiled form or a straight form. It has both forms. Similarly, God's coiled form is his transcendental non-material aspect, and his straight form is his mundane aspect. But this explanation is not without its problems. If God's personal nature is eternally knowledge and bliss, how can the material world, which is temporary, full of ignorance and miserable, be said to be just another form of God, right? So that's why all these will have a difficulty, right? Means in the point is that it develops faith in the Lord, worship of the Lord, and that development of devotion. Then in that way, all the schools are good. But if you're going to try to take the logic to its last point, then only Achinta Veda Veda Tattva can deal with that. Right, because they only go up to a certain point. Yes.
I was thinking that the verse explains this, and many contradictions are gone just by the first verse of Brahma Samhita. Ishvara Brahma Krishna Sachidananda Vigra Ananda. This is like, it's all in there.
It's all in there.
It's so beautifully like combined.
Yes. It's interesting. I was once we went to one of the Madhva a scholars, but he's also a musician, you know, it was how to deal with the Brahma Samhita in what they call, what it's called. So it's a system where you partially sing it. It's not a full singing, but it's partially sung, like Prabhupada does, like with Gita, with those tapes of it. It has a melody like that, and it's according to raga, like that. So this person is so expert that it's like if you're dealing with Gita, each shloka that changes its mood or what it's about, he would know how to change it, the raga and everything. It was so good. So I asked him about that. So he went through and he did something. But his comment was after reading that Brahma Samhita, that opening verse, and he says, it's got to be something wrong with the Sanskrit here. Because he couldn't relate philosophically to it, because it was just something he didn't understand. So it wasn't, it's like, it's a lower thing. You know, oh, there's this fault. Otherwise he would have said, there's this fault or that fault. This was something that was higher that he just couldn't grasp. You know, but it was kind of like, you know, we asked him about the music. You know, we weren't discussing the philosophy. So therefore he did that. But it was very interesting. It's answered, but it's just over the head, so they can't catch it. Like that, yeah. The Chaitanya school reconciles these seemingly disparate views of God's relationship to the world by arguing that the Vedic scriptures testify to God's achintya shakti, inconceivable powers. God is simultaneously the cause of the world in every sense, and yet distinct from and transcendental to the world. The example is given of a spider and its web. The material of the web comes from the spider's body, so in a sense the spider may be taken as the material cause of the web. Yet again, the spider and the web are always separate and distinct entities. While the spider never is the web, at the same time, because the spider's body is the source of the web is not different from the spider. In terms of Vedanta, this is a major problem, basically, in all philosophical or religious systems, is this one point of God in the world. And because of that, then they come up with all kinds of strange and wonderful things. You know? So the Chaitanya, Achinta Veda Veda Tattva, that can deal with it. But it's the only one that really clears it. Most will deal with it unless you're super, super analytical and just keep following the point that each of these four schools will answer it, that you'll be satisfied. Right? But if you keep going, then there's going to be a problem. So what happens is It's not that one person, because like that is sees all the things at once. Is that at one at a time, they're looking at this school to that school, then here's a weakness, or that school to this school, and then here's a difference. But if you can see them all at once, you can see that there's not a problem. They all are correct, but it's not correct to say that's all there is. You know? Does that make sense? So that's why they're not wrong, because one may say, oh, which is right? They're all right. But the problem is them all being right and being able to function at once, that's Achinta Veda Veda Tattva. Right?
Will they claim that there's any problems with Achinta Veda Veda Tattva?
I haven't heard anyone complain about it.
Or comment at all?
Generally, scholars from other lines read Jiva Goswami's work just because it's so amazing in its presentation. And you can't defeat it. You can't do anything with it. So they're always impressed by it. You know, generally they don't follow it, but they're just impressed by the, you know, scholastic element. Yeah, I've never heard anyone complain. Generally they complain how are Mleches and Yavanas doing brahminical work. That I've heard. Yeah, that you get a lot of complaints about. But the other I haven't. Mayavadis, of course, will complain about anything.
Yeah.
But you know, that's another thing.
The example of the spider is also interesting because it can retract the web.
That's another thing. It can also pull it back into itself. But in here, it's not being brought out. You know, when you're talking about creation, destruction, then you'd take it to that. But here, just to show the difference. You know how Krishna says, I am everything, but at the same time, I'm still separate from that. So that's establishing that point. In terms of Vedanta, the substance of the web is God's Maya Shakti, power of illusion, which manifests from the real, but is not real itself. Not real simply means that the features of Maya, the Triguna, or the three modes of material nature, goodness, passion, ignorance, are temporary. Reality is that which is eternal, God and God's Surup Shakti, spiritual energy. The temporary features of the material world are manifestations of the Maya Shakti, not of God himself. These features bewilder the souls of the world just as flies are caught in the spider's web, but they cannot bewilder God. That means the spider doesn't get caught. See, it's real that the spider is, and that's there, but the thing is that there's open space there. That's an illusion for the bug, or it's something that you can pleasantly sit on and take a rest there. It's also an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
But the web is there. Mm-hmm. You understand? So, yeah.
The Mayavadis say the web is not there.
They just say there is no web, and there is no spider. Right? Yeah. Relation of God to the individual soul. Indian philosophy abounds with speculations about the self or soul. The doctrine of Charvaka, an ancient thinker who opposed the Vedic teachings, is thoroughly materialistic. The word thoroughly means he is thorough. He thought the body itself to be the soul and consciousness to be a product of material combination. There is no God, and the purpose of life is to gratify the senses. Charvaka's philosophy was strongly opposed by Buddhism, which is yet no less materialistic in its outlook on the soul. Buddhism says that soul does not exist. So the one says the soul is the body, and the other one says just there is no soul. So it's not that it's technically any better, right? You know. The very concept of selfness is false. That's what Buddhism says. The body is but a wave in a stream of events. So that means they're string theorists?
Yeah, could be.
Like that. So, you know, so they believe in waves, not in particles.
Yeah.
Like that, so. Okay. So, Vaisheshika, they're particles.
That's particles.
Okay. The only truth is emptiness. The only truth is emptiness.
That's a t-shirt.
The only truth is emptiness. It sounds great because there's two things that don't make it.
Yes.
Just bend your head around it. That's definitely the bumper sticker. Yeah. The only truth is emptiness. Yeah, that might be a good.
In the parking lot.
Hmm?
The only truth is emptiness in a parking lot.
Yeah. Or on the highway. These two philosophies represent the extremes of human materialistic mentality, right? In other words, one's the extreme of the idea that I can enjoy of karma, right? Optimism, right? We'll get into that. Then the Buddhism is the extreme in pessimism. Mm. Because at least in the Mayavad, there's at least the Brahman, so there's kind of, there's some variety of existence, though there's not individual existence. But in Buddhism, this does nothing exist at all. that's really destructive here. The mode of ignorance is really like on its... So we see the mode of ignorance makes these two extremes, right? You know? Yeah.
Also the two functions of the mind.
Oh, accepting and rejecting, yeah. That's a good point.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, no, that's a very good point. Right? Mm. In other words, there are the two extremes. The mind, it accepts and it rejects. So Charvaks is the extreme in accepting, and Buddhism is the extreme in rejecting. So therefore, they're both just mental speculation. Mm. It's just all on the platform of mind.
Right. So can we say that the modern scientists, they are following this Charvaka.
Basically.
The body is everything.
Yeah. No, that's interesting, though they're so intelligent, they're actually on the lowest level of consciousness. Mm-hmm. They're on Anamoy, like that. So, you know, them and that, you know, little 3-month-old baby are basically on the same level of consciousness. Right? Just one, And they both seem to be scientific, right? You know, testing everything. You know, just one sticking it in the mouth. You know, the other one sticks it under the microscope. You know, it's like that. So
sounds like real that. Funny when both of them speak.
Yeah, it sounds funny. You can't tell what they're talking about. That'd be funny, right? It's like the old lady in the audience there, you know. The guy gets up on the podium, speaks his philosophy. She turns to her, I think he's hungry.
That's a nice scientist.
Nice scientist. Yeah. Charvaka is a... Oh, here it is. Sankalpa doctrine, arising from the mental phase of accepting, sankalpa, the material world for enjoyment. Buddhism is the vikalpa doctrine, arising from the mental phase of rejecting, vikalpa, the world in frustration. Sankalpa and vikalpa are mere dualities of the mind which inevitably bewilder one who has no knowledge of what is beyond matter, in other words, spirit, because they both don't deal with spirit. That's an interesting thing.
Without the transcendental knowledge, the mind is bound by this
too. That's all it does anyway. So now if it's accepting spiritual, rejecting material, or accepting what's favorable and rejecting what's unfavorable, then the mind is nicely engaged. It's properly engaged. But when it's just accepting and rejecting on the basis of sense gratification, then it's always a problem, because whatever you accept at some point isn't desirable anymore. And so then... becomes the problem. Yeah, it's really nice. It's because that's what the mind does. Sankalpa, vikalpa. The 6 darshans of the Vedic scriptures all confirm that the individual self is non-material and eternal. Right. So now we've discussed the general concept of Vedanta, then Shankara, then the 6 schools, and then the non-Vedic, right? Like that. And the 6 darshans of the Vedic scriptures all confirm that the individual self is non-material and eternal. The goal of existence is liberation, and each darshan proposes a means by which the soul may be liberated from material existence. In Vedanta, there are 2 basic explanations of the soul. One given by the Mayavadis and the other given by the 4 personalist schools. Mayavadis say there is only one soul, the Supreme Soul. Right, so why would you have to say Supreme Soul? Because there's only one soul. Mm-hmm. So it's just their soul. Then there's the ones that are not souls, right? You know. Yeah.
The contradiction of every step, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the Supreme Soul, God, the conception of a plurality of individual souls is an illusion. Personalists refute the Mayavad view by pointing out that if it were true that God is the only soul, then that would mean that illusion is more powerful than God, because the so-called one soul fell under the spell of Maya and became the unlimited living entity subjected to repeated birth and death. Mm-hmm. This is tantamount to saying that there is no supreme being at all. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the personalist version is that although God and the soul share the same spiritual qualities, Satchitananda Vigraha, formed of eternity, knowledge, and bliss, still a difference remains between them. God is Vibhu, all-pervading, whereas the jivas are Anu, infinitesimal. Right, so I guess you can take it that the exact relationship between soul and God is described differently by each of the four personalist schools. These viewpoints are synthesized by Chaitanya school, which gives an example of the sun and sunshine to show how God and the soul share the same qualities in oneness and difference simultaneously. Just as the sunshine is the marginal energy of the sun, so the souls are the marginal tatasta shakti of God. As sunshine is made up of unlimited photons, infinitesimal particles of light, God's tatasta shakti is made up of unlimited infinitesimal spiritual particles, each one an individually conscious personal being. The soul is called kshetragya, field. Kshetragya, kshetra, field, gya, knower. Because each soul is conscious of his particular field of awareness. In other words, his own body and mind. The soul is like a candle flame, the limit of his luminescence being the limit of his field of awareness. God is called vyasti kshetra and samasti kshetra. As Vyasti Kshetra, God knows everything about each individual soul's individual existence, i.e. he knows unlimitedly more about the soul than does the soul himself. For instance, God knows all of the past incarnations of each soul. And as Samasti Kshetra, God is the knower of all souls at once, in their totality. Right? Because here's also, like, when you get intelligence, what's the difference and what is the commonality? Right? So that's the what do you call it? Vyasti and Samasti. Right, just like we had before is Sankalpa Vikalpa. That's what the mind does. So the intelligence, it does Vyasti and Samasti. Like that. It tells the difference and it tells what's saying. So God knows the difference in everybody, the uniqueness and everything, and he knows also what's the same. He can see it all at once. Because the soul is infinitely small, this power of knowledge can be obscured by Maya, just as a ray of the sun can be blocked by a cloud. But clouds are created and destroyed by the influence of the sun on the earth's atmosphere. Similarly, Maya is always subordinate to God. The individual souls can come under the control of Maya, but Maya is always under the control of God. Just because we're so small. Right, so that's important to note. We understand that. Then we take shelter of the internal potency, because that's big. Right? Even if you just want to say by size, then you're talking 3/4 to 1/4. Okay? You know, so it's definitely bigger. But technically it's the Sarup Shakti. That means it's the whole thing. Right? So if you take shelter of the Sarup Shakti, which means we're taking shelter of devotional service, then one is safe, one will see properly, yes.
If you're talking about the origin of God, this analogy of the cloud can bring out the element that God cannot be covered by illusion.
That's how it'll be used in that way also. It's just the clouds cover our vision of the sun, but it never covers the sun. Though it even looks and it's so immense and vast and everything like that. But. Yeah, it's just like, means, in other words, the example, it'll be used by what part is relevant to the situation that has all these others. So that's why these Vedic analogies are so good because they have so many aspects. So, does that make sense? See, like the potato, it has limited aspects, you know, like that. So, but it works, you know, because people like to eat. And that, you know, and potato seems to be the most common vegetable that everyone can relate to. This one devotee was telling me, he was in this one area, and he was dealing with these kids, and he had, you know, he was on the playground there, and he had his, you know, what he was eating. It was, you know, some, I guess some vegetables and this and that and like that, and he was eating that. One of the kids asked him, "What is that?" He said, "Vegetables." And he said, "What? What are vegetables?" He'd never heard of vegetables. You know, he tried to explain. He says, "Oh, you mean like potato?" That's the only thing he ever knew, was potatoes. He had never seen, you know, a carrot or a cauliflower or anything else. Nothing. He only knew, you know, maximum was potatoes. So at least, you know, seems to be the universal vegetable, right? Yeah.
My cousin became a vegetarian, so her grandmother asked her, "Don't you get tired of potatoes and gravy?" That was the extent of her
her understanding of yeah, vegetables.
Or in support of the potatoes.
We have 30 different kinds of potatoes growing in our place. Yeah.
No, there was a doctor family in England, and they would buy every week 25 kilo potatoes and had a machine which would unpeel it, fry it, and cut. And I mean, 25 kilos of potato a week is something. We had a kilo and a half. So it has an application.
Has yeah, yeah, no, it's pretty, it's quite universal.
And the family is four people.
Yeah,
four
people. It's a big family.
Yeah, yeah.
Four people.
Yeah, it's not bad. Okay. Abhideya. According to the Advaita Vedanta, the process for attaining, so that was Sambandha. So how do you establish God living into the material world, right? So we see is that that means there's going to be a, means the non-Vedic is going to be in one category. And it's just an extreme from gross materialism on one side of acceptance of sense enjoyment to gross materialism on the other side of rejecting it. Then you have the Vedic school. So they'll all oppose the non-Vedic. You understand? Even Shankara means ourselves and Shankara will have the same opinion about the non-Vedic. Hmm. Does that make sense? Then when you get into Vedic, then there'll be a difference between the Advaitavad and the Vaishnavism. All right? So all the Vaishnavas will agree that Shankara is wrong, right? And this, on the same points. Mm. Then within the Vaishnav, then there'll be differences of how much the Lord is involved or not involved and these kind of things with the material energy, the living entity, the relationship, all these different kind of, you know, subtle aspects. Mm. Simply because God being unlimited, it's very hard to acknowledge everything at once. So that's the, then that means is you can only reconcile all that by a philosophy that accepts everything at once. Mm-hmm. Right? So then Lord Chaitanya's philosophy then is the highest because it can reconcile all the differences that any others might have. But it's not that there are differences, there's something bogus there. It's just there's that limit of how much they can appreciate of the absolute total truth. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So one takes one aspect prominently, someone takes another. Some places just overlap, so they'll agree on some points, but there's some points that are different. Yes.
So the definition Vaishnavism from our point of view is that actually what they're saying is correct.
Is correct.
However much they're saying.
But yeah. But it'll get you to that particular level. Like they'll get you, means your how you say, Ramanuja's Vishishtadvait. Yeah, so Vishishtadvait, Dvait, means Advait will get you up to Brahman. Mm. You know, on a good day, right? Vishishtadvait and Dvait will get you to Vaikuntha, right? Vishuddhadvait will get you to the parental rasa. Mm. Dvait, Advait will get you to the conjugal rasa, but not Braj. Mm. Achinta Beta Beta Tattva can get you to Braj. So in other words, they're just actually just what realms they take you to. Does that make sense? Yes.
In a TV interview with Prabhupada, when he was on the news, and the reporter said, "Don't you find a contradiction taking truth from the Quran, the Bible, because Prabhupada was talking about the inclusiveness of Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. And Prabhupada said, I find no contradiction with the goal of religion is to know God and how to know God and how to love Him. So, I mean, even with apart from Vaishnavism and the Vedic school that Vaishnavism can, I mean,
all yeah, can accommodate everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if everything is able to be connected to the Lord on from someone, some perspective or another, that means all thoughts and everything that's there, its principle is okay. Mm-hmm. The difficulty is this: most deal in detail. So therefore they can't, there's a problem. Or they can't see the principle in it because they don't accept that particular principle or don't know about it. But if you accept all the principles, that means everything taken. But the point is it's taken in its principle, which is the pure Vaishnava philosophy. But the particular form it manifests through, that's not necessarily. You know what I'm saying? Just like you can say, an ant is a manifestation of strength. You know, God's strength can be appreciated in the ant. Right? You know, so you can say that's because it can lift whatever it is 6 times its own weight. You know? So that's strength. But at the same time, it is extremely small. So it's not like, you know, many living entities would have a problem in defeating an ant. You know. So then the problem comes is just which perspective you're using in that. According to Advaita Vedanta, the process for attaining liberation is cultivation of spiritual knowledge. Right? So you're cultivating spiritual knowledge. We also cultivate spiritual knowledge, but we also practice it in a mood of devotion. Well, they think that just by cultivating the knowledge, without the practice and without the devotion, that will be attained perfection. So they've taken part of what's correct, but not enough to actually make it viable. Right? According to all Vaishnava schools, the process for attaining the highest perfection in life is devotional service to God, Vishnu or Krishna. Right? So that's the common point. Vaishnava means one who worships Vishnu in devotion. Mm. Right? So they're all bhakti schools. Like that. Yeah. The Chaitanya school of Vedanta teaches that the soul has an eternal function, which is to serve God. This service may be rendered directly or indirectly. In direct service, the ecstasy, bhava, a spiritual love, shared by soul and God is fully manifest in a transcendental personal relationship called rasa, sweet exchange. In indirect service, the soul serves God under the illusion of forgetfulness, under maya. The soul is attracted by forms of matter instead of forms of spirit. He is overwhelmed by emotions such as lust, anger, greed, madness, illusion, and envy, which are nothing but perverted reflections of spiritual emotions. Right? These emotions impel. Right? So, in other words, what's going on here is that he's directly serving God through devotional service, being conscious of his relationship with God. So he's working under the internal potency in serving the Lord. Right? But indirect means he's still serving the Lord because it's the Lord's creation, it's the Lord's material energy and everything. But he's unaware that it's the Lord. So therefore, in illusion, he thinks it's not the Lord. So all living entities are actually indirectly serving God in the material world. Right? They're all God conscious because what it is that they're attracted to in the material world is God. But in illusion they think it's the material energy itself, the matter itself that's attractive.
That's the Chaturloki second verse, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Because whatever they value, that's actually Krishna. But they don't know. Those who know it's Krishna, then they get liberated from that. Those who don't become entangled. So in other words, there is the thing in at least ours, others don't really touch on it. But because of us being able to deal with all these things simultaneously at once, there's not a problem. It's that every living entity is God conscious. Everyone is, how you say, indirectly serving God. But Maya means they don't know that. So as soon as you remove that illusion, then they know they're serving God. So now they're serving consciously, and then that's the point of favorably. Because actually everybody's serving God, but the problem is not favorable. Right? It's pious then it's favorable means it is something that could be offered to God, but you're not offering it to God, so it's still unfavorable. Does that make sense? That's why pious activities are in both categories. Right? Means it's something you could offer, but it's not being offered. Does that make sense? So that overlap is there. So then Krishna conscious means making them aware of their position as servant of God, and then whatever they're doing, do it in connection with God. Right? Does that make sense? So that gives that universality that holds everything together. Does that make sense?
So, in a previous talk, you're saying that the pious driven, they get too attached to that identity. Sometimes harder for them to turn to off to make the offering.
Yes, because it's nice. They're conditioned by goodness. It's not so bad. While the followers of the non-Vedic or the it's kind of like in the negative, right? It's like it's very not dark today. Yes. So then they suffer under the modes of passion, ignorance, greater. So the impetus to take up spiritual life may be greater in them. Right? That drive is there. While the others, then, that drive's not so much there because life isn't so bad. But they're pious that they're following it. While the others are impious, that's why they're suffering. So you get these contradictions. Does that make sense? But the ultimate point is, if it's connected to the Lord, that's what's good. Right? It's just you're connecting an inferior position. So now you bring that to the pious platform. That's a superior position to connect. But the point is it's not the superior position that makes it superior. Its superiorness is that it's a better offering to the Lord. That's all. That's what makes it superior. Not that this particular matter or this particular endeavor is superior to that one. You know, that's the example of wet stool, dry stool. It's all stool. It doesn't really matter from that point. But we'll make a distinction. Oh, this stool has been dried to perfection, you know. Oh, this dry stool is coming from this particular valley here, you know, and like the, you know, so all these kind of different, you know, kind of, how you say, sophistry and snobbery is there, and how they discuss all these things and try to make it something special when it's not. Like that.
One of the things of some Indian pious people comment is how the Westerns, when they come, they're so enthusiastic to do service, to dance in the kirtan, they're amazed by that.
Yes, because they don't have it, because it's, you know, they're already busy doing things that keep them satisfied, so they don't see the drive. They know it's good. You know, even the Westerners know it's good. If somebody's really absorbed in devotion, it's one of those things that means if they're being pious, no one can say it's bad. You know, like a Western, you know, saintly person, you know, who's so absorbed in things, they'll all say it's good, but at the same time, they just all can't relate to it. So it's just one of those things. It's a nice story, and then let's get back to you know what I'm saying. Let's go. You know, what's happening in the texting, you know, and stuff like that. Does that make sense? Like that, yeah. Okay. So these emotions, means the one in indirect service, these emotions impel him to try to control and exploit the material world as if it belonged to him. The result of the soul's false lordship over matter is endless entanglement in samsara, the cycle of repeated birth and death. Right? So in other words, the one takes you towards Krishna. In other words, there's one path. You're serving Krishna going towards him, you're serving Krishna going away from him. Right, so the direct is going towards him, the indirect is going away. You know, so at one end you get Krishna and that wonderful interaction eternally, and the other one you end up in hell. So that one's not so great.
Less ideal.
Yeah, less ideal. Even if you go in a bucket, it doesn't matter. It's still not good.
Even if it's a bucket of halibut?
You wouldn't go to hell in a bucket of halibut. You'd be going towards Krishna.
Yeah, that's
the whole point.
Because
the other one, it doesn't say it's a bucket of halibut. It's an empty bucket, and they're in the bucket. So it means if they're in the bucket, they don't say it's great being in a bucket covered with halibut. They just say in a bucket, that's all. Yeah. You know, you're going one way in the bucket, and the hull was going the other way. I'm in the wrong bucket here. Sorry?
Is it a ghee bucket?
It could be. It could be. You know, it definitely could be a ghee bucket. Yeah. That's one thing. It never gets into describing the bucket. It's just, all you know is that's... Prayojana. According to the Advaita Vedanta, the ultimate goal of life is the realization that the soul is the supreme. Right? So in other words, their goal is that, means you're supreme. Right? You are that. But the problem is then if you are that, then how is it you are that? It means because that you and that are the same. You know, so there is no you and there is no that. You know, so it's. According to the Vaishnava schools, the soul is meant to love God. But God grants the soul a minute independence of choice whether to love God or not. Mm-hmm. Love is voluntary. If God forced the souls to love him, then love, as we understand it, would have no meaning. By loving God, the soul automatically attains mukti, liberation. Conversely, by not loving God, the soul comes under the maya shakti. Right? So, in other words, if he's directly serving, he develops love. If he's indirectly, then he gets in maya. There are two kinds of liberation, jivan mukta and videha mukti. Oh, jivan mukti. Jivan mukti is attained even before the demise of the physical body. When the embodied soul dedicates all his activities to God as an offering of love, he is freed from the bondage of karma. Right? So that's jivan mukti. Right? So the devotee is already liberated. If he's absorbed, means when you're performing pure devotional service, you're liberated. You're not performing pure devotional service, then, you know, less liberated, right? Does that make sense? So the point is, if you're always, you're liberated, right? Okay. After death, he attains videha mukti, an eternal situation of devotional service within the realm of Sarup Shakti, the divine energy. Because videha means it's the body, so he's freed from the body. The other one, while alive within the body, he's liberated. And this one, then after death, then he's liberated and he's got situated in the spiritual world. The videha mukti is described in Chandogya Upanishad 8.12.3. Thus does that serene being, arising from his last body, appear in his own form, having come to the highest light by the grace of the Supreme Person. Right? Yeah, I see. Having come to the highest non-darkness by the... yes. Okay. The liberated soul moves about here, about there. This is still the quote. They're laughing, playing, and rejoicing in the company of women, vehicles, and other liberated souls.
Actually, it's the unlowest undarkness.
The unlowest undarkness. Okay. As Baladev Vidyabhushan explains in the Govinda Bhashya commentary on Vedanta Sutra, the liberated souls are in threefold union with the Lord. One, they are in the spiritual realm of God, which is not different from God himself. Two, by their constant meditation upon him, God is ever within their souls. And three, they are in union of love with the personal form of God that appears before them. From this state, the concluding code of Vedanta Sutra declares, Anavriti Shabdat. There is no return to the material world. Verily, there is no return, for the Vedas so declare. Okay, so by his dham they're there, by him being within the heart, and by their exchange with him. So all these are there. So then we can see is that they're always with the Lord. So this idea that Krishna, you know, in separation, technically, it just means that this third one, they're not interacting. Mm. Right? But the first two are always there. So they're always connected with the Lord and always experiencing that love. So the bhav means is that union with the Lord means the constant meditation upon him, but then he appears within that meditation. So actually then all three are there in the mode of separation. You understand? Mm. But it's not that physical form in front of you. It's his personal interaction on that second platform. I guess we get into that in the end of Jivadharma, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll get into that later. Okay, and that is the end of this one. Okay, and basically the end of the class today. Okay, so then that means then we'll start on part two. So here then we see, so we have, okay, overview of the six schools of Vedanta. Then we'll go through each of the schools, the Advaita of Shankara, Sri Sampradaya, Brahma Sampradaya, Kumara, Rudra, Brahma Madhva Gaudiya, and then some appendices to comparative analysis of the schools. Right? Mm-hmm. So in here then you get into their Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana, the specifics of them, that concept of the God, material nature, and the soul, right, and how they'll define these things, and then anything that makes some uniqueness, the life of each person, of each of the acharyas, some uniqueness, you know, what is the why the school came about, everything like that. So it'll have a little bit of history and also the philosophy. So that we'll get into starting on Thursday, right? Today's Tuesday, right? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Classes on Thursday.
Early classes?
Sorry?
The seven classes.
Oh, 7 o'clock. Yeah. Means Thursday. No, Thursday, Friday, it's all there. Yeah. I think we only have, I know the next, any break will be sometime in the third week of February. Actually, fourth week, right?
It's more of the fourth.
Yeah, it's more the fourth week. Like that. There's some days when we do the Pune installation. But otherwise, basically, from now through then, should run fairly smoothly.
When the girls go away, classes will be on?
The girls go away before that. They go in the middle of February.
What, to Puri?
Yeah.
Not that I know of. No, shouldn't. I mean, it just means that you all have to put the rugs down and pick them up, but other than that, that's the only major effect that is there. Yeah, so then, how you say? According to the southern tradition, so God willing and the creek don't rise, then the classes will go on. Okay.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Shri Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Janitai Gaurapremanandi.